the assistance of this committee for finance, but also the select committee for appropriations. We are the same people, same members, just two different chapters, that we engage with you. So feel welcome this morning, relax. Come and tell us what you are doing and how the Twin Peaks Bill will affect, what effect will it have on your work. Also to the National Treasury, welcome. Roy indicated to me he's out of the country, and a matter that I think you might just take us through again through is the amendment, these two or three pages. I like it in red, and then also looking at section 106, 3C5, the amendment there, the last point. On page 2. Apologies, Mr.
Gobalo. Thank you, Mr. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, colleagues and guests. There is one apology that we have received from honorable members. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Gobalo. He's standing in for the committee secretary, Mr. Rento. Mr. Rento told me and was granted a day's leave to attend to other serious matters outside Parliament. We also recognize the presence of Honorable Notara, our whip of the committee, and Honorable Makashuku, which was just arrived. Then we have here Honorable Mohai, the chairperson of the Select Committee for Appropriations, and Honorable Esrak of Kumalanga. It's been so much rain. I think we must do all this right there. And the Honourable Lance from Marshall Bay, the Southern Cape. And then the Honourable Mokashupi from my neighbouring province, Northwest. I'm from the Northern Cape. Proud to be in the biggest province in South Africa, but all the people in my province fit into the Cape Flats. And that's the reality. And that's things that we have to deal with, and the Treasury knows that, in terms of service delivery distances and whatever goes with that. So welcome to everyone, we've done the apologies. Treasury, I'm going to put you on the floor immediately, that we be efficient and effective to take us through the amendments, because not all the members were present last Friday, not this Friday, 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago. That you just take us through that as well. And then, members, if there's any questions, we gave you homework to work through the bill again, to get your fingers into the papers, to put to the Treasury before we take the ombudsman. Thank you, Treasury.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just to say that the South Africa Treasury team, we also have our CARB representatives as well, and they will be supporting us in the discussion. So the amendments that have been proposed and have been circulated, there are three changes which is in the table in terms of the paper that was circulated. These changes in the table were in fact, just to remind you, agreed in terms of the proceedings of the Scots proceedings, but were not actually implemented in the final draft, in terms of the final approved draft. So we just want to take you through those. The remaining two clauses, so one, both of them in fact have emerged in relation to the FRC amendment bill, and we will talk you through those as well. So in terms of the changes that had in fact been discussed and agreed but were not implemented, the first is on clause 38.2. And this relates to, there has been some discussion where we've talked about the overlap between the credit regulator and the conduct authority and the various roles and responsibilities allocated between those two agencies. And so both clause 58.2 and clause 165A are intended to better delineate how those responsibilities are shared. So in 58.2, you will see that there is an omission of the word only. So it was intended to make very clear that the conduct authority can make conduct standards relating to credit providers that are already regulated by the Credit in terms of the Credit Act, but only in those matters referred to in section 108. And just to be clear, those conduct standards refer to issues relating to governance type requirements. In clause 106.5, this then further strengthens how the conduct standard powers can be exercised. And what it is intended to read is that, again, for if we read 106.5a, in relation to a credit provider regulated in terms of the National Credit Act, a conduct standard may only be made in relation to a financial service provided in relation to a credit agreement and that is provided for in section 108. Again, it's clarifying that the conduct standards for those entities regulated in terms of both the conduct authority and the credit regulator can be regulated in terms of governance. And the intention of both of these clauses is because what you don't want is for there to be a duplication of responsibility. In other words, both the conduct authority and the credit regulator being responsible for setting standards on the same thing. And then the final change was a change to the schedule. Sorry, a change in terms of the consequential amendments, and this is to the Financial Markets Act. And this is a clarification to what is meant by counterparties to add in the words to transactions becoming the buyer to every seller and the seller to every buyer. In effect, this is in relation to a central counterparty. It's explaining what a CCP does. And it's making that clear because normally in a counterpart, in a given transaction, for example, it might be myself and Janine, we are the two parties engaged in that transaction. What a central counterparty does with infrastructure is it puts itself in the middle. And it then becomes, if I'm selling the transaction, I will sell it to this entity in the middle. And the entity itself will then be on selling it to Janine, who will be buying it, but no longer from me, she'll be buying it from the CCP in the middle. And this change in the clauses to make that clear. Would you like me to continue with the other clauses? Okay, then the clause 163CB, this relates to issues of when it is appropriate or how it is appropriate for financial service and product providers to be either refusing to deal with a customer or withdrawing their services from a customer. And that could happen in a situation of an insurer where an insurer might refuse to agree to cover your house under a policy for whatever reason. It could also talk to a bank account and the bank refusing to do business with a particular customer. And this has emerged also through issues relating to the FRC and the exercise of its powers. What this gets to is what has been considered historically as a purely contractual relationship between the financial institution and the customer. And that's correct, it is a contractual relationship between those two parties. But in exercising the elements of those contracts, we believe it must be done fairly and with transparency. And so the intention of this clause as proposed is to make sure that that is achieved. And then lastly, on item 3, this relates to some of our investigations, our inspections and investigations clauses. On this, we haven't yet covered the final proposal. Janine, perhaps you can step in.
Thank you very much. As the committee may be aware, the President referred the Financial Intelligence Center Amendment Bill back the National Assembly for reconsideration, particularly related to concerns regarding powers amorphous searches contained in some of the amendments in that bill, particularly relating to Section 45B of the Financial Intelligence Center Act. And the Standing Committee on Finance is currently holding deliberations on the bill, and they have had some further hearings, and opinions have been obtained from counsel, and we have also obtained some opinions from counsel on the concerns relating to that bill. And we have also, in order to align the inspections and investigation powers contained in the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, we will be preparing, well, we are preparing, and we will propose some further revisions to ensure that the provisions in the Financial Sector Regulation Bill will be aligned and constitutionally compliant. We understand that the Standing Committee should be completing its deliberations on that bill tomorrow. And then in light of the finalized wording that's agreed upon by that committee, we will then be in a position to finalize and develop a proposal, complete a proposal that we can then present to this committee regarding the clauses, particularly clauses 132 and 137 in the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, but also possibly some slight revisions to a couple other clauses in that Chapter 9 of the bill, in order to ensure that the searches in terms of investigation and inspection powers in terms of the bill will be constitutionally compliant. So in the next committee meeting, we should be able to present detailed proposals to the committee, which we hope will be very sound and constitutionally compliant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That's a complete summary. So, great.
Are you done?
We're done.
Thank you. Members, questions? That was a repeat of that specific Friday's meeting. If I remember correct, the 3rd of February, when we returned from our oversight. Dan, on board with the shipping.
Chairman, good morning. thanks for the opportunity and member of the Chair, part of the reasons why we are public representatives is that we need to regulate and not regulate for purposes of regulating, but to bring a difference and to deliver services to the people. But when you do so mindful that South Africa has a bitter past, and when you regulate with the intention of trying to bring into place things that will change the lives of all South African citizens. Now, if I've got to explain to a layman, I apologize for the fact that I was not in the meeting of the said chair, as I said, also in the Constitutional Review Committee that I attended on the said day. But when you do so, chair, then you begin to regulate, and you just regulate only after ease and all that. What do I then say to an ordinary person in the street? That these changes that we are introducing would have an impact later into improving their economic and socio-economic conditions as they are currently. That it is intended to better their lives. Because it will be very difficult for me to go to my constituency and say, we are regulating this because it refers only to a particular division or sector. And we change the word only for an example. What is the impact of that change? What is it that we really want to achieve out of it? Thank you, Chair.
Captured the question? Anyone else? No, none? You may reply. Thank you.
So, just to take a step back, I think the broad effect of what the bill is doing in relation to credit, as you are probably aware, we have had an crisis, if we can call it that, in South Africa. I think we've got about, you know, just around 10 million people who are starting to default. I think around 3 or 4 million of those are going to be heavily indebted. And then there are some questions around, you know, what exact triggers we should be looking at. But the point is, we've had a recent history of extreme lending abuse, abusive practices employed by lenders across the board. The credit regulator has taken strong steps working together with, across government, it's been the DTI, Treasury, etc., Department of Justice. We've been working together to curb these practices and support the credit regulator in taking action and the appropriate action where necessary. And in fact, we've got the credit officer today who will be able to talk more as well about the experience there. This might seem like a small and maybe a negligible change, but what we're needing to ensure is that where we have multiple regulators who are responsible for the same financial institution, we have to make sure that their jurisdictional boundaries are clear. And why that's important is, firstly, because we don't want a situation where there could be problems on both sides. Either there can be gaps, which we've had historically, and the gaps mean that credit providers are not regulated holistically for their business. Or you could have a situation of duplication where you then get into, it opens up the potential for two regulators to be setting equivalent type standards on the same institution, which leads to not only inefficiencies, but those standards could be contradictory. And ultimately, in both scenarios, where you've either got underlap or overlap, is a situation where the regulatory effectiveness fails. And so, both in clause 58.2 and 1065A, these changes, however minor it might seem, is set to improve and make very clear which authority has got which powers to be setting standards on the credit providers. And that's to ensure that that the credit regulator and conduct authority are able to coexist smoothly, but most importantly, as you point out, it's not about the regulators, it's about actually the regulated financial institution should have a clear set of requirements, which requirements ultimately make sure that borrowers are protected.
You done? Thank you. Members, we will take this also to the public hearings. It's not only the bill, it includes the amendments that goes with that. Thank you. Advocate Jenkins, feel free to come in when you think you want to say something. So please feel free to just indicate to me. We welcome also the staff from the ministry. Cindy just walked in. And our gentleman there at the back. Why are you sitting in the back? The dwarfbank. Honourable members, that brings us to the ombuds family. I see you on the agenda, they call it the ombudsman. Someone must explain that. Why is it a man? Why not just the ombuds? Maybe it's an international term, I don't know. We will first give the opportunity to the ombuds from the referring to the long-term insurance, then the banking services, then short-term insurance, and then the credit ombuds. Because we are a bit ahead of schedule, I'm going to give each of you 20 minutes. Not the 15 indicated on the program agenda, but I'm going to give you 5 more. And then we will engage with the questions, and then there will be an opportunity to reply. I want members that we note, and it must be minuted, that in future we also, in our oversight program, built in a visit to the ombuds as they are sitting here. Before the meeting, I engage with them. When we visit the Reserve Bank, etc., in the Gauteng province, we can fit that into our program as well to make it cost effective. So we will look at that in our program for 2017. Long-term insurance, this is the usual team. Welcome again on the day we call Valentine's Day. So have a very good Valentine's Times Day to all of you. And for the men and your wives and those. Yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm Nikki Lala Mahan, I'm the credit ombud. I note that you gave us 20 minutes each, but I think what we also have is, whilst all of us are going to do our individual presentations, we have a joint presentation on the impact of the bill, which I will do after my presentation, so that will take a bit further time.
You get the director team.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
For this part, you will be charged in terms of your team.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
I will facilitate the meeting.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think that's Rod McKellen. Thank you.
Very important also for the ombuds. This is being broadcasted live, so you're speaking to South Africa. I think it's very important in terms of education, educating our people outside. Something we learned in Mexico when we did our oversight trip there. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'm the Ombudsman for long-term insurance.
Can you speak into the mic?
I'm the Ombudsman from long-term insurance. I'm assisted here today with Mr. Shishali from our office, who's an assistant ombudsman as one of the adjudicators in our office. I didn't come prepared to answer the question about the use of the word ombud, but it's an old word coming from one of the Scandinavian countries, meaning a representative of the people who represents the people in public disputes, and it has no gender connotation at all. Our office was established in 1985, it's more than 32 years old, and it is structured as a voluntary financial ombudsman scheme, which is recognized by statute, which is the Financial Services Ombuds Schemes Act. And the office itself, in its corporate structure, is a voluntary association which consists of 10 members. Each of those members is an adjudicator in our office and is an assistant ombudsman such as Mr. Shishali here. That body has got legal personality, and it corporate oversight is being conducted by our independent Ombudsman Council. The office renders a free complaint resolution service to resolve complaints against life insurance companies which arise from insurance of life, funeral, credit, health, disability and investment policies. The office, we believe, operates effectively, efficiently and in accordance with fair procedures. An important feature of our office and of each of the officers represented here today is that we have an equity or a fairness jurisdiction. In our office, that jurisdiction is also entrenched in our rules. Those rules enjoin us to give due consideration to equity, asks of us to keep in balance the scale between subscribing members, in other words, the insurance companies, and the complainants. It specifically asks us to ensure that the insurers act with fairness and with due regard not only to the letter of the contract, but to the spirit of the policy. We are an independent and impartial office, and for our corporate governance, we are accountable only to our council. Our rules specifically provide that we do not take instructions from anybody when it comes to the exercise of our functions. The office is readily and easily accessible to complainants. There's no formal complaints procedure which is prescribed. Complaints can be done telephonically, in writing, by email, through the internet, and we find that complainants have no difficulty in lodging their complaints with us. Throughout the adjudication process, we maintain confidentiality of all the communications between the parties and the office. And those communications are privileged from disclosure, and in subsequent, if there's ever a subsequent court case, they can only be disclosed by consent of the parties or by an order of the court. We have no monetary jurisdictional limit, and over the years we have received some very substantial claims in money terms. I'll explain very briefly how the office works.
Sorry to interrupt. Honourable members, as the sites are being dealt with, just number it for yourself. It's not numbered. When you refer to in your question time for refer to a page. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got rules which regulate our complaints process, and those rules guide and assist us in effecting the resolution of complaints. It's an informal procedure. Often there is a misconception on the part of complainants that they expect us to operate like a court of law. That has no place in our system. Often we deal with complicated factual issues. Those are, in most of the time, resolved on the papers, and there is a procedure that we can have a hearing to resolve such disputes. But even such a hearing is not a trial, and it is still an informal procedure. We often stress to complainants that in order to conduct their complaint in the office, they do not need a lawyer, and it is only on rare occasions that we find lawyers involved in the process. The whole process is informal, it's non-confrontational, and we attempt to resolve the disputes firstly by mediation, by reconciliation. Often we make a recommendation to the parties how to try and resolve the matter, and if all those attempts fail, we make a determination. Part of our process is that there's always a provisional ruling made first, and then if it's challenged by any one of the parties, a final determination follows. Our decisions are binding on the insurer, but not on the complainant. informal internal appeal procedure, and the office also engages an independent external assessor who is a retired High Court judge who hears and decides complaints against the office. That procedure is reserved for service complaints, and people can complain to the independent external assessor on the way in which we handle a complaint, and it is not an appeal against the outcome of a complaint. That is one of the steps in a whole process aimed at quality control to ensure that our service remains of a high standard. I just furnished some key statistics which will give an indication of the volume of work done by the office, and I'll just round them down. Last year we received about 10,000 requests for assistance. There were more than 5,000 formal complaints. We finalized nearly 5,000 cases. And the percentage of cases which were finalized either wholly or partially in favor of the complainants came to 37.4%. Recovered for complainants in lump sums was more than 187 million rand. I point out that those are lump sum amounts and they do not take account of benefits such as disability benefits, where a monthly benefit is paid to the complainant. The office has the power to award compensation to a complainant for inconvenience or distress suffered as a result of poor service by an insurance company. And last year we awarded nearly 500,000 rand by way of compensation. If I turn to some statistics on the types of benefit in the complaints finalized, it will give you an idea of how our work is spread, and I'd like to just refer to the funeral insurance and the credit life insurance. Those two types of policies comprise 45% of our work, and why this is important is that people who take out this kind of insurance are generally speaking people in need, financial need, and they form a significant portion of the consumer public which come to the office for assistance. Then a summary of our cases finalized will also give an indication of how our work is made up. Poor service accounts for about 50% of the total of cases. Claims declined come to nearly half of all the cases finalized, and then there are various smaller components to reflect how our workload is divided. Mr. Lala Mohan, the credit ombud, is going to speak about the impact which the financial sector regulation bill will have on all our offices. So I do not imagine that there will be much individual discussion from the individual offices. I just briefly referred to some challenges and possible solutions. I selected only one of them, and that's poor complaints handling by insurers. And other possible solutions are the publication of complaints data. We've been doing that for a number of years, and we find that it is an effective mechanism to get better service from the insurers. I've already referred to the fact that we may award compensation for poor service, and then we know that at present there's draft legislation underway, financial sector regulation bill, the Treating Customers Fairly initiative, and the policy protection holder. Those all serve to improve the standard of service. And then lastly, we have a liaison committee which is made up of industry representatives and which acts as a liaison body between our office and the industry. And we have fruitful interaction with them whenever an industry problem arises and which needs to be addressed. And thank you. That concludes the presentation from our office.
Thank you, McLaren. You want to add? You covered 100%. Thank you. Honourable members, you have to, if you brought the bill with you, chapter 14 deals with the homeless. Listening to Mr. McLaren, it's very clear that there must be cooperation and coordination among yourselves, but also in terms of the bill referring to the Ombuds Council, the role of the Ombuds Council. And the Treasury can note this one, you can reply later on. The Ombuds Council has a chairperson and it's got a certain function. But who else serves on the Ombuds Council? I can't find that in the bill. That's a very good explanation regarding the board of the council, but not the council itself. So I'm just registering this. I picked it up and I mentioned it when Roy was here on the 3rd of February, that he also knows that. Please note your questions. We will have a question time after we got all the presentation. Now we go into the banking services. All of us have insurance, all of us are clients of banks.
Good morning, Chair, to you and the members of your committee. My name is Clive Hillay. I'm a banking ombudsman. Thank you for the opportunity of briefly giving you a sense of what the banking ombudsman does. Let me make some preliminary remarks. We are also of the view that coordination and cooperation between ombuds is important. But as my colleague has said, Mr. Lala Mahan will go into more detail. Similarly, we also share your concern about the Ombuds Council. Having said that, though, I thought I should follow the following format. And to start to you that our mission is that we are dedicated, we are dedicated to providing banks and their customers with a quick and efficient dispute resolution service. We are impartial, we are independent, our work is confidential, and our services are free. How do we go about doing our work? We don't do our work in a vacuum. We have regard to a number of articles. So in adjudicating or assessing a case, we will have regard to the code of banking practice. We will look at good banking practice as well. We will look at international best practice. We will look at case law, and of course we also have equity jurisdiction. And our vision is simply that we will be known by all banks and their customers for our impartial, well-reasoned resolution of complaints, and our service standard is to resolve all our complaints within 4 months. But you'll see later on that approximately 74% of our complaints are resolved at what we call the assessment stage. And that on average approximately 35 days. So 74% of our complaints or resolved within 35 days. And if you want to look at the slide up and up, that gives you a very brief overview of some important statistics. So you'll see that you'll note that in a year we receive approximately 5,000 plus complaints. We resolve almost all of those complaints.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And on average, all complaints in the office, on average, and I'm sure you will appreciate that some complaints are considerably more complicated than others, but on average we close our cases, all our cases, within a maximum of 52 days. We have recovered last year 15 million rand on behalf of consumers. And we can also make awards for distress and inconvenience. And the statistic I touched on earlier, you'll be able to see that within 0 to 2 months, we close over 60% of our cases. 2 to 4 months, 27%. And all our cases are done and dusted within 6 months, maximum. If you want to look at the next slide, please. Gives you an idea of the number of queries and inquiries that we receive from the public. People either walk in with a query or they are referred to the office or they come by the call center. And so, Chair, with respect, you'll note that almost 23,000 people have some sort of query or question or complaint with the bank. But what worries us though is the mismatch between that number and the number of complaints or cases actually open. So 23,000 people have some sort of query or complaint or question but only 5,000 cases are open. So there's a huge mismatch between queries and actual complaints. We are not sure how that happens. We try to ascertain the reason, but we have not been able to do so. And maybe that's an area that could be fruitfully investigated.
It can be a case study.
Yes. Thank you, sir. So then the next slide simply gives you an idea of the number of cases open per bank. And not surprisingly, the biggest number or highest number of cases are open against the bigger banks. And just bear with me for a moment. If you were to look at slide number 8, I'll get back. That's only the bad one. I can't seem to get back. Page 8.
We've got the hard copy.
Yeah, be that as it may, you'll note that the three highest categories are once again, not surprisingly, ATM complaints, internet banking, and mortgage finance. And I suspect that with banking becoming more increasingly electronic, and customers being actively persuaded not to come into a branch, I suspect that the internet banking complaints are likely to escalate.
That's also the reason that staff shouldn't use it in banks, because we can observe that as well.
Be patient. Let's go to number 11.
To the committee section, that you, with your leadership, take up this matter of equipment. This room, it is E249. There are always hiccups when it comes to information on the screen, etc. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Slide 11, that was the point I made earlier. We closed 74% of our cases. What I would like to say on that slide, we closed 74% of our cases at approximately 35 days maximum. But the point I want to make on that slide, though, is that the office is an informal, speedy dispute resolution of body. We are not a court of law. We are not a substitute for a court of law. And in the next slide, gives you an idea of the mediation done and recommendations, which is the second stage. The next slide is a comparison between 2015 and 2016 and the money is recovered on behalf of the public from banks. The office also, in the next slide, although not legally obliged to do so yet, we ascribe a sincere outcome to every case closed. So every case closed is allocated one or more of the six TCS outcomes. So that's very
what is TCS?
It's treating customers fairly.
These are best members. Treat customers fairly.
Treating customers fairly. And in making an assessment whether an institution has treated its customers fairly, the initiative lays down six parameters against which you can gauge or measure the conduct of an institution.
Can you name that?
Yeah.
Please.
So it's very important here that we do that so that we can immediately, of the 5,000 plus cases, we can immediately determine where the greatest fault or problem lies with the institution. And so we have already ascertained that the biggest or highest complaint against financial institutions is the lack of clear, understandable information. So what we do in turn is to visit the institution and say to them, or say to it, you seem to have a problem in this area and that area and the next area, and we suggest that you address those three problem areas. So in many ways it acts as an early warning system for us. We can pick up, we can identify trends and then alert the institution and suggest that they embark on remedial action. So the next slide deals with what we call demographic data or data. And so what we do, Chair, is that we capture details of the three highest complaints in the different geographical areas and amongst the different population groups. And in that manner, we can also once again identify which population group is most falling victim to a particular kind of banking fraud. And then once again, we can tailor-make our marketing and awareness creation program to fit or to address the need, and similarly, we can speak to the financial institution and bring it to their attention. And similarly, they can institute remedial action. And so that's the purpose of the demographic information. And then on slide 18, it's very, very quickly gives you a sense of the structure of the office and our governance. So our board is made up of 8 members, 3 industry representatives. The majority of the board are non-executive independent members. So there's no danger here of the industry manipulating or taking charge of the scheme. We have a staff of 21, 11 lawyers. Minimum qualification is an LLB. And very important to share to you and your committee is that the banking ombudsman does not report to and is not accountable to the bank. Banking ombudsman reports to an independent board of directors. And if you were to look at slide 23, it gives you a sense of how the independence of the ombudsman is guaranteed and protected. The banking ombudsman enjoys security of tenure. That means he cannot be dismissed, cannot be fired, and certainly can't be dismissed for making a ruling that the bank all consumer groups are not happy with. Naturally, the banking ombudsman can be dismissed for gross negligence or senility, but not for the ruling or the decision that he makes. And then lastly, maybe, following slide, We entertain claims up to 2 million for an individual on condition the cause of action has arisen within the previous 3 years. And we entertain claims for small businesses with an annual turnover of less than 12 million, 10 million rather. I think the rest of the presentation deals essentially with how cases are resolved. And you may read that at your leisure, but there's one point I would like to make, Chair, with your permission. And since we are dealing with the financial sector regulations, I think that one of the provisions of the bill is that consumers of financial services should have unimpeded or ready access to impartial dispute resolution bodies. And we think that's an important point. We've taken that to heart, and we've done a number of things to facilitate that. And so, for example, a complainant can now lodge a complaint with my office telephonically. You needn't come into the office. And you can telephone, even from a known case, and lodge a complaint.
That's a place called Gary.
And so we've done that case.
That's recorded, that conversation.
And the conversation is recorded, a case is then opened, and the recording is attached to the actual case. Because it has to be recorded because the bank needs to listen to the recording as well. And so that's the one thing. The second thing we've done is to do out simpler cases telephonically as well. So instead of writing a longer report and making you wait for 23 days, we do it on the telephone. We do a telephonic assessment. When you lodge a complaint, we allocate a reference number, which you can then use to track the progress of your complaint. And you needn't call the office. You needn't wait to speak to Mr. X or Mrs. Y. Track the progress of your complaint yourself. And lastly, with mediation, we've now introduced electronic mediation. So so that you can sit in your office and the bank can sit in their office, and I can sit in my office, and I can coordinate a mediation between the parties, and I can talk to the bank separately without the customer here. I can talk to the customer separately without the bank here, and I can talk with both of them when necessary. So we've done all of that to facilitate access to consumers of financial services. And I'm very happy to take any questions. And just maybe one last point. All the information that I've touched on is published once a year in fair detail, and it's available to the public. Thank you for the time.
We must engage with that document you just showed us, that becomes part of our business of each year.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for that presentation, members. I hope you noted your questions. I've got one specific about the rural area, but we'll come to that. Short-term insurance, a good lady.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having us here. My name is Deanne Wood, and I'm the Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance. Before I start my presentation, and while it's being loaded, it's perhaps worth mentioning that each of our offices publishes an annual report every year, and in the same format that the banking ombud referred to, and that can be made available if necessary. This morning I plan to just briefly deal, very similarly to my colleagues, with our mission statement and values, a very short introduction to our office, the jurisdiction that we have in order to deal with complaints, our governance structure, some statistics relating to our office, and some complaint trends, and then just also briefly some main operational areas of concern that we are currently facing. Again, like my fellow office officers, our mission statement is to resolve complaints fairly, efficiently and impartially. Our office was established in 1989, and it provides consumers with a free, efficient and fair dispute resolution mechanism, offering no risk complaint submission to consumers to resolve the disputes with insurers. It's free to the consumers, although that can sometimes be open to debate, because whilst the insurers do pay our fee, that is obviously collected from premiums that are paid by the consumers. So we are very aware of that and very aware of the responsibility that we owe to consumers, because ultimately that's where the funding comes from. We are currently recognised under the Financial Service Ombuds Schemes Act, which will be repealed. We act independently and objectively in resolving disputes, and we are not under the instruction from any other party or body when we exercise our authority. The insurers that participate in our scheme, they are members of our organization, and they have agreed contractually to abide by our decisions. The decisions, however, are not binding on complainants. So if they are unhappy with our decisions, they are free to take the matter further and go to court. Both parties, both the insurers and the complainants, may appeal to an internal appeal tribunal that we have set up in our organization. We act as a mediator or an informal arbitrator, and we don't represent either of the parties to the dispute. Like the other officers, our decisions can be based on law and also on equity. We don't give legal advice, but we do provide assistance to complainants to advise them as how best to deal with matters. So we will tell them that certain documents are needed or advise them if we think that they should get expert opinions, and we'll point them in the right direction as to how to resolve, best resolve their matters. Our jurisdiction is, unlike the Office of the Long-Term Insurer, our jurisdiction is limited, and in relation to personal lines complaints, we only deal with short-term insurance claims under $2 million, except in relation to homeowners insurance, and there our jurisdictional limit is $4 million. We have a limited jurisdiction over commercial insurance policies, where we deal only with businesses that have a turnover in their last financial year of less than $25 million. I've listed there some of the main areas in personal lines insurance that our office deals with, being motor homeowners, which is buildings insurance, and then household, which is the contents of a home, cell phone, travel, disability, credit protection insurance. We do deal with a wider range. That just gives a example of the primary areas that we deal with. Our governance structure, our terms of reference that are published, and I've given you there the web page if anyone is interested in looking at those terms of reference. They define the powers and the duties of the Ombudsman. I've also given the web link to our Board of Directors, so you can have a look at who they are and where they come from. But our board comprises four consumer representatives, three insurer representatives, one representative from the South African Insurance Association, and that's a trade association which represents all short-term insurance companies in South Africa, two independent directors, and one representative from the FSB. It's worth saying that in order to become a member of the South African Insurance Association, it's obligatory that an insurance company becomes a member of our scheme. So we have a very good participation of insurers in our as members in our scheme. Brief summary of the statistics from last year. The total number of complaints that our office received was around 15,000. Some of those we didn't have jurisdiction to handle, or for one or other reason the case didn't open. That might be because it was resolved by the insurer before the case was opened. But we received around about 15, and we opened over 10,000 complaints. So you can see from that statistic that our office is dealing with almost double the amount of complaints that the other ombuds deal with. We managed to close 8,631 of those complaints that we received, and our average turnaround time is 91 days. The total value to consumers that we managed to recover in the resolution of our complaints was around 90 million. The number of calls, we have a dedicated call center in our office, and we employ 5 people to answer calls and take calls. Like the banking ombud, we also allow calls, complaints to be made over the telephone, and we have almost all of the official languages represented in our call center, so that parties can call our call center and make a telephonic complaint if necessary. Last year, our call center received 71,000 calls. The next slide just gives a breakdown of complaint trends, just to show the registered cases. Now that's the breakdown of the previous figure of the number of complaints opened, which was 10,175. That's breaking down in finer detail the way that those the type of claims. So as you can see, the majority of claims are motor related, almost 5,000 complaints registered in relation to motor vehicle insurance, and homeowners is the next. Other relates to disability, cell phone, or one of the other ones that I listed earlier on. As far as non-claim related, we also deal with, for example, where there is an issue relating to an excess that is charged, or a premium, or a cancellation, and that just gives an indication of the number of non-claim related cases that we dealt with. Just to touch on some main operational areas of concern for OSCE, obviously this is not an exhaustive list, and we have a lot of challenges in our organization, but I thought I would just touch on some of our main areas of concern. Consumer education and awareness remains a problem.
Sorry to interrupt you. This is, I don't want this. This committee doesn't want interference coming from the system up top here. Can someone please attend to that? I don't know who is doing what, but we don't want this noise. Thank you. I don't know where it comes from. Yeah, it's a mysterious voice floating somewhere. Yeah. Let's try and continue on the level.
So as I was saying, consumer education and awareness is one of the main areas of concern. We do endeavor to educate consumers in relation to systemic issues that arise in the industry. We publish regularly in the media and try and raise awareness around concerns we have with the insurance industry, or areas where we think consumers may fall foul or not be aware of a specific policy provision. We also try and advertise the service that we offer, but many consumers still don't know about our organization and don't know that they can approach our organization for relief, or don't know about the extent to which they can approach us. Obviously, we are at under financial constraints, so our resources to educate and publish and create consumer awareness and advertise are limited. But within that budget, we do have an active PR marketing campaign. Another major concern and challenge for our office is the high number of complaints that we receive against the number of staff that we are able to employ in order to deal with complaints. Our office registers approximately 1,000 new complaints per month. And this means that each assistant ombud must deal with and resolve around about 100 complaints per month, which is an incredible number of complaints to have to deal with. In fact, at the World Ombuds Conference that we attended in Armenia last year, in my discussions with other ombuds around the world, it does seem that our office has the highest number of complaints per professional in the world, and that is a real challenge that we face. We have a staff complement of around about 42, I think it is now. 14 of those are qualified lawyers, 5 are dedicated call center operators, and the remainder are administrative and support staff. We're an NPO, and we have limited funds for employing additional staff, and that always remains a challenge. And another challenge is, with limited staff and a mission statement that is to resolve complaints efficiently, to try and maintain low turnaround times and an efficient resolution of complaints while still providing a good service to the parties who approach us and giving attention to matters where detailed attention is deserved. Just in closing, Judge McLaren from the long-term ombuds office mentioned publishing insurance statistics. We also publish insurance statistics in our annual report. Our report launches in May, but if anybody is interested, a copy of our last year's report can be found on our website. And we publish statistics in relation to complaints submitted in respect of each insurance company to our office. That's a fairly new innovation. That publication of insurance statistics has had quite a strong impact on the industry and has resulted in the industry working very hard to resolve complaints in their own office before they get to ours. And there's quite a lot of competition around the publication of our insurance statistics. Some of you may have heard adverts by insurance companies bragging about their statistics in our office, and that has had a very positive spin-off for insurers attempting to resolve complaints and deal with their insurers before complaints are submitted to our office. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I made one remark. Receiving the highest number of complaints in the world.
No, not the highest number of complaints in the world. Our assistance, if you look at the number of complaints we receive and the number of staff that we have in order to deal with those complaints, our staff members are required to deal with around about 100 complaints a month. That figure is one of the highest in the world. So it's not the number of complaints. There are, the UK office is way bigger than ours, but their staff are 4,500. So it's a lot more than ours.
Looking at your turnaround time, you're doing very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Finally, we come into the credit ombuds, Mr. Lohan. Welcome, sir.
What do you report?
I am informed members and technicians are on their way to solve this interference. We recognize also the presence of Honorable Gaila. Welcome, Honorable Gaila.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My name is Nikki Lala Mohan. I'm the credit ombud. What I have on the agenda today, I'm going to go through the mission statement and values of the credit ombud. I'm also going to do a brief introduction to the office of the credit ombud, what we do, the statistics, complaint trends, what are the challenges for consumers, and areas of greatest concern, and how should industry address these issues. The mission statement and values. We will effectively resolve disputes between members of the credit industry and credit receivers with regard to credit and credit information matters. So, Honourable Chair, we do two things. We look at issues relating to credit information, that is the so-called blacklisting, that is adverse enlistments on the credit bureau, and we do that for anybody that accesses the credit bureau. So we do that for everybody that makes a credit decision by looking at the credit bureau and your credit history and your credit report. That's the one thing we do. The other thing we do, and this came later in terms of our mandate, is that we deal with matters relating to credit in the non-bank sector. The reason why non-bank, because my colleague, Advocate Clive Pillay, the banking ombudsman, deals with banking credit. So those are two important things that we do, and it's important to understand that distinction. And as you may know, that credit history, so-called blacklisting, previously was very, very politically charged. And, you know, we tried to minimize the effect of that and get some people to understand the benefit of a proper credit report. We also, an educator to the public, we do a lot of consumer education, and at all times we act honestly, independently, and fairly, balancing the rights of all parties. Our values are fairness, independence, and honesty. Fairness is that we act in the interest of all parties, we don't take any sides. We're independent, again, no sides. No individual or organization will be unduly influence us. And obviously, honesty is very important in our game, and that we openly deal with issues brought before us, asking the relevant questions and communicating clearly and transparently. What are we? We are a voluntary association to provide a fair, fast, and cost-effective dispute resolution mechanism. We're an alternative to the courts. It's not a form of a legalistic approach. And then many of my colleagues touched on this formal legalistic approach, the informality thereof. But what it means is that we don't go through the entire legal process of discovery and subpoenas, etc. We request information, and many, many times we get the information that we request, so as to enable us to make a decision on the matter before us. The very important thing is that our service is free to consumers. We are bound by a constitution in terms of reference. We are only accountable to an independent council, also known as the board, and that council has quarterly meetings, and it has various subcommittees to ensure proper corporate governance, such as the human resources, finance, risk and compliance, as well as corporate governance. Just some what our council consists of. The majority of our council members are not industry participants, and we have three consumer bodies on our council. That is the Women's National Coalition, we have the SA National Consumer Union, SAMCU, and then we have Blackfish. Then we have some independent members. We have consumer activists, we have an attorney and mediator, we have a journalist, Soweto Ntuli Zungu, we have another journalist, Patricia McCracken, who writes for BDF Admin in the KwaZulu-Natal area, and then we have a consumer activist, Hassan Lorgert. And then the credit constituency, which is made up of the following. It's the Banking Association, the Consumer Goods Council, the South African Credit and Risk Reporting Association, and that is an organization called SACRA. And SACRA is a very important hub into which all credit information is sent for them to be placed on the bureau correctly. We have the National Clothing Retail Federation, and they represent the likes of Truworths, Foschini, etc. The Motor Vehicle Finance Association, Microfinance South Africa, the Credit Bureau Association, and the non-large bank lenders. Non-large bank lenders are lenders such as Old Mutual, Sanlam, etc. So what do? We're an operative jurisdiction in terms of the Financial Services Ombuds Schemes Act. This Financial Services Ombuds Schemes Act is going to be repealed by the new Financial Sector Regulation Bill. We are a public benefit organization, which means that whatever fees are paid to us, it can be tax deductible. Initially, we started our office only dealing with credit bureau information matters in 2004. But then there was a gap for people which had non-bank credit and needed their disputes resolved. And so in 2012, we extended our mandate to include not only credit information, but as well as non-bank credit complaints. And once again, I mentioned earlier, we do a lot of consumer education, acting as an educator to the public. So that's also one of our big mandates. Some of the terms of reference and jurisdiction, I, in my sole discretion, can determine whether a complaint falls within our jurisdiction. In making that decision, I've got to act independently and objectively. I've got to have fair regard to fairness, justice and equity, and that balancing the rights of the consumer on the one hand and the rights of subscribing members on the other hand. The important thing is that members are bound by my decision. So if I make a ruling, the member has to accept that ruling. Fortunately, in the past, since the office has been established, there's never been a need to make a formal ruling, which means that credit providers' members abide by recommendations or decisions that we make. However, a consumer is not bound by our decision because the consumer continues to have the right to go to court or to seek alternative redress or go to an initial credit regulator. So the avenues open to the consumer doesn't end with our office. So if we make a determination or a finding against a consumer, it's not the end of the matter for the consumer. He can still pursue his constitutional right to fairness in other fora. Some of our statistics. These are the statistics compiled for the entire year 2016. Last year we had complaints and inquiries totaling 14,343. 32,000 calls were made to our call center. We have an internal call center, which is staffed by about 5 people. We opened up 4,123 real disputes. We saved 10 million for consumers. Now, in our context, saving money for a consumer is quite different from my fellow colleagues in the manner in which they save money. You would see the long-term insurance talk about 126 million and another 70 million. Because of the nature of their work, the insurance policy normally pays out in millions, etc. But in our world, these are poor people that come to our offices, and this is where reckless lending takes place. So most of this 10 million is in relation to possible reckless lending. Now, the manner in which we work is that we mediate with the credit provider. We could raise the issue of, look, what we see here is real reckless lending, which means that we've got an obligation to report it to the National Credit Regulator, who then has to take action against that credit provider who could lose their credit license. But when we raise this, and without admission of liability, without admission of guilt, they offer to write off the entire balance owing on a personal loan or a micro loan. The biggest amount that we've individually written off for one person was an amount of 450,000 rand. Now, you can imagine if you have a personal loan or a number of loans amounting to 450,000 rand and you have no obligation to pay it anymore, that is life-changing. It changes a person's life. So we saved 10 million for consumers last year, and that is money that we put back into their pocket, which they would not otherwise have had. We have a media equivalent advertising of 25.1 million. This is all media that we do on various radio stations, various television stations, and these stations will give you an AVE, the average value of the equivalent of whether you would have paid for this. This is the amount that you would have paid. Unfortunately, we don't have a budget of 25 million to pay for this, but we get that as a free service because we're doing consumer education. People want to hear about, especially in these difficult tight times with credit, how to save better, how to look at your credit report, what to do in the event that you are in difficulty, etc. And then finally, it takes us an average of 52 days to close a case. Honorable Chair, the world average in closing cases, and that's set by INFO, which is the International Network of Financial Ombudsmen, they vary between 60 to 65 days. So the South African ombuds are doing quite well in closing cases within the average under 60 days. So that's our statistics. What are the complaint trends? Credit is an issue that affects all of us. Very much the lifeblood of the economy, but very much the lifeblood that can really debilitate you, especially if you have a bad credit record. A bad credit record keeps you out of the economy for up to a period of 5 years, depending on what type of adverse adjustment. If you have judgment against your name, you're out of the economy for 5 years because you are listed for 5 years, and nobody will grant you credit because of that enlistment. So it's very important that you fix your credit history up and get out of that. So simple things that you, for many of me and you, would take for granted. And the complaint trends that we receive is issues around statements of account. You know, one would take for granted that I must get a proper statement of account, but many people do not get a proper statement of account. And the reason why they don't get a proper statement of account is that the credit provider is hiding a lot of fees there. So if he provides you with a statement of account, it's disclosure. You'll see why you're charging me this. And these kind of things come up more in prescribed debt and books sold to various people, etc. So they don't get a statement of account. So it's an incorrect, disputed balances, payments not reflecting, disagreements over interest charges. And the National Credit Act clearly states that you have a right to receive a statement of account. Unfortunately, some credit providers don't give you a statement of account, deliberately so, because if they do, you will see what they're charging you. Then incorrect information reflecting on credit bureaus. This is one of our big issues that we deal with. Many people are put onto the bureau incorrectly. If you're placed on a credit bureau incorrectly, it affects your creditworthiness, it affects your right to acquire wealth, to accumulate assets, etc. And a lot of our time is taken up in terms of correcting that incorrect listing, if it is so. So we do a lot of that. And then service issues, you know, copies of documents, you want statements, you want paid-up letters. Paid-up letters are very important now because with the amendments to the National Credit Act, if you have a paid-up letter, you can go to the bureau, they will place it on record that this account has been paid up. Here's the letter. It's a very important thing. People don't get those paid-up letters. A couple of years ago, one of the big issues in our office was garnishee orders. Garnishee orders really was the most number of complaints that we received about 3 years ago. However, since the case with the Stellenbosch University and which took the High Court in Cape Town, which kind of outlawed the garnishee orders and made it unconstitutional to a certain extent, we find a total decline in garnishee orders. The good thing about that is that the message has gone out to people that you can't use garnishee orders or emolument attachment orders willy-nilly as you did in the past, especially the abuse of getting a garnishee order in a jurisdiction where you do not live. And if you remember that case with the Western Cape, with the University of Stellenbosch Law Clinic on behalf of those farm workers in the wine region, was that many of them lived here in Pal or whatever, but they had the garnishee orders authorized against them in jurisdictions such as Kimberley and Kidmansworth, and, you know, there was total abuse of that. But since that case, we've seen a total decline in garnishee order cases because people are now playing ball. You do get those, they take a chance. But where is it was our number one complaint, it has dropped down to probably the lowest one at the moment. So, you know, the effect of that case, you can see the positive part. Another issue is the issue of prescribed debt. You know, a debt prescribes after 3 years. There are certain conditions in terms of it must be uninterrupted in those 3 years. And we find this in many, many instances, and this is the practice among credit providers. They go through a normal collection process. You fail to pay 30 days, they'll give you a soft call. Pay. You fail to pay 60 days, they get a bit harder with a letter of demand. 120 days, they've got no time for you anymore. They write that book off, they sell it to somebody. That person to whom they sell it then pursues legal action against you. And in many instances, we find that that legal action goes past a period of 3 years. So the debt is prescribed, but they're still collecting on that debt. And we're finding a lot of that comes to that comes through our office. So what are the challenges and how to address some of this? What we find is that far too many consumers do not know their rights in relation to credit. They don't know where to turn to when they experience financial difficulties. They don't know how to budget or handle their financial affairs to their benefit. And they don't understand the legal implications of the contracts that they sign. And Honourable Chair, the reason for this is that unfortunately in South Africa, we are a consumption-based society. We want things that we cannot afford to impress people that we don't know. And we buy expensive sneakers, expensive sunglasses, all on credit. And, you know, that consumption-based mentality needs to change. We need to foster a culture of savings. And that's something that is societal, that can only start from grassroots. Children's education, school education. And we need to change that mindset because, you know, earlier Catherine Gibson from the National Treasury mentioned about we have 21 million active consumer consumers on the bureau. Of the 21 million, 10 million have adverse listings. And what is an adverse listing? An adverse listing is that an account where you have not paid for more than 3 months. So of the 21 million credit active consumers, 10 million are out of the system because they're already in default. And we need to address that. This over-indebtedness is a bubble that's going to burst. It has so many ramifications, political, social, economic, everything that. And we need to do something in society to change that mindset, to get people into getting out of debt. So we also need a coordinated financial education program for consumers from a very young age. We need to introduce financial education in school syllabi. I know that the Department of Education and Department of Higher Education is building these into their various programs, but we need to give that impetus. We need better information and explanations provided in the time of contracting. Again, because of our consumption-based need, we're not interested in what's written in the legalese. I want that plasma TV. Don't give me that story. Let me sign, load the box, I'm going to watch my DSTV at home. We're not interested in what happens when I default. And I guess if I put this question to everybody in this house, many of us can lift their hands to say, we don't read all the fine terms and conditions. So it's something that we need to be educated about and be wary about. Ask questions. What happens is this? No, we just want sign and take. And then ongoing communication and building relationship with clients so that they know when to turn to in trouble. And there are positive aspects that I will deal with later, which flow from the financial sector regulation bill, which will allow us to address some of these challenges. So also more should be done to assist consumers with historical debt problems to rehabilitate themselves. You know, when you are seriously in debt, suicide is an option. We've had instances of people committing suicide because of debt. Because of the embarrassment of being unable to feed your family and the difficulties you find yourself, the easiest way out is I'm going to commit suicide. And we've had instances of threats of suicide. Consumers saying, I'm so desperate, I feel like taking my life. And we need to do something about that. I spoke about education to assist all to become financially independent. Saving, we need to encourage saving. We need counseling for consumers in need. Appropriate and affordable debt consolidation. The point is appropriate and affordable. There's many debt consolidation programs out there. Question is, are they appropriate? Are they affordable? Are you saving in the long term or are you putting a noose around your neck for an extended period so that you could solve your problems within normally 5 years, you're extending it to 7 years. And then we need to curb the escalation of debt due to high interest and legal fees. Honourable Chair, that's my formal presentation on behalf of the credit ombud to members of the select committee. So if you would allow me, Honorable Chair, is that on behalf of all my fellow colleagues, I now want to talk about the implications of the Financial Sector Regulation Bill. And are you okay with that? Do you need a comfort break,
but
or do you want to...
Yes, but if
you wish to take a comfort break or 5 minute break, it's your call, Mr. Chair. It depends on how you... Thank you. Thank you. Honourable members, this part of my presentation is dealing with issues that relate to the impact on the Financial Sector Regulation Bill on Chapter 14 as far as they affect ombudsmen. Firstly, we welcome the provisions of the Financial Sector Regulation Bill as they relate to ombudsmen because we support the unified regulatory approach in the financial ombudsman sphere. Without unification, we're not going to achieve the aim that we want to achieve because everybody's working in their own closets and nobody's talking to each other. We welcome this bill because it creates that uniformity, it creates a coordination between the various regulators, which we welcome. We hope that it works. That's all that we ask for. Some of the issues...
That's why we are there to call.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Yeah.
So, relevant introducers to come and come.
Okay. Some specific areas of the impact. We have identified five main themes under which we summarize the impact which the enactment of the bill could have on our respective offices. These are continued existence. Many of us are accredited currently by the old Financial Services Ombudsman Act. So we all go before the AFSOS Council, issue them all our documentation, do a presentation, and then give us accreditation. The Financial Sector Regulation Bill will allow our continued existence. For the purpose of this presentation and for easy reference, I've listed the various sections so that when you deliberate, it's easy to cross-reference. So the continued existence, there are various sections, section 3016, under the heading Savings of Approvals, Consents, Registrations, and Other Acts, provides for an ombudsman scheme that immediately before the repeal of the Financial Services Ombudsman Schemes Act came into effect was recognized in terms of that act must be taken to be a recognized industry ombudsman scheme as if it had been recognized under this act. The important thing about that for us is that it ensures continuity of service to the financial customer, and I'm using the term financial customer deliberately because that's the way it's defined in the Financial Services Regulation Bill, so we can continue to do what we're doing with the least disruption. And that is very important for us because, you know, what if this bill, you know, didn't acknowledge us that we had to stop work, there's a whole lot of cases, and then you've got to go once the bill is passed, go get further accreditation. The continuation is welcome. Raising awareness. One of the biggest things that all our ombudsman schemes suffer from is that people don't know about us. And we constantly got to do a drive. Chair, you ask, what is an ombudsman? You know, and people, can you understand what a layperson would mean to? What do you do? I'm an ombudsman. So raising awareness of that is very important. Without awareness, people don't know where to go. Once they find that you exist and what you do is the service you provide, then you're the next best thing since sliced bread. And we need to pursue that. So the objective of promoting public awareness of ombuds and ombuds schemes and the services they provide is enshrined in the bill and will go a long way to promote much needed awareness of our offices. And then I quote the sections inter alia which underpin those objectives. 196.3 is that the industry ombuds scheme, the industry ombuds scheme requires the members of the industry to inform financial customers about the scheme. That's very important in my world. My fellow colleagues have the advantage where their members in their industry promote them on their literature, etc. The banking ombudsman, on all his documentation or on all banking documentation, you will note that there is reference to, if you have a problem, go to the banking ombudsman. Similarly, the long-term insurance ombudsman has that. Similarly, the short-term insurance ombudsman. Unfortunately, the credit ombud, with such a broad federal church, some members do it, others don't do it. So I look after micro-lenders. The guy around the corner, mom and pop micro-lender, he's not going to put my name on his literature. You've got big companies like Edgar's, Foschini, the JD Group. Well, one of them, the JD Group, took up the challenge and put our name down. Now, if that is done, creates awareness, more complaints, the cycle continues. So from my point of view, speaking for the credit ombud, I'm totally, totally welcome this provision. Section 209.1, the ombud council must, as soon as practical, after this part comes into effect, establish and operate one or more centres to facilitate financial customers' access. Again, access. Honourable Chair, we, amongst all of us, have a share call number. We have a 086 number which you can call directly to with your problem, and it will put you to the correct ombud. Apart from that, we also have our own call centers. The uptake in terms of that share call is not what we want it to be. We want it to be much more, people to be calling that much more. But probably there's an dichotomy between do you advertise that number or do you advertise your own number. But we have that at the moment. We do get calls through that, but we also have our own call centers. So, the fact that the bill is going to allow proper access, etc., fully, fully welcomed. A financial institution must disclose to its financial customers applicable ombud schemes and how to contact and submit complaints to those schemes. Again, it follows 196. Again, in my world, hallelujah. From now onwards, they will have to tell the customers, no matter it's a micro loan or whatever, if in the event if you have a problem, you can go to the credit ombud. Honourable Chair, this issue of cooperation and consistency came up previously, and again, we welcome it. We support the approach that greater cooperation between the various offices processes and requirements will ultimately benefit the financial customer. Some of the relevant sections in support of the intended outcome. 201.5, Ombud Council rules must provide for a consistent approach and consistent requirements for all ombud schemes, as well as cooperation and coordination between ombud schemes. And 213, collaboration between ombud and ombud. And again, we're doing this on our own. We're preempting the bill. We collaborate a lot. We work together. But again, the ombud schemes and the ombuds must cooperate and collaborate with each other regarding complaints about financial institutions in relation to financial products and services, including developing processes and procedures to jointly hear and determine complaints on their own initiative or as they be required by the Ombud Council rules. Let's say that we are taking our own initiative and we do coordinate and cooperate, as you can see, with our presence here today. Honourable Chair, another issue and another theme is effectiveness. An ombud scheme can only be effective if there's buy-in from the industry members from the relevant industry. The current voluntary ombud schemes will enjoy greater industry participation, again to the benefit of all financial customers. The sections that underpin that theme, section 2113, if a financial institution provides financial products and financial services and there is a recognized industry ombud scheme that provides for the resolution of complaints about financial products and financial of that kind, the financial institution must be a member of that industry ombud scheme. So if you're providing financial services or whatever, you must belong to an industry ombud scheme. Again, in my world, very, very welcome. I'm a voluntary organization. Honourable Chair, there are certain members that don't want to pay me. They say we're not obliged to pay. We're voluntary. and there's nothing I can do to them. There is nothing I can do to them if they withdraw from my scheme. I can't take them to court. It's a voluntary scheme. I'm based on a constitution. I'm based on terms of reference. So I've had big members, honorable chair, that walk away and don't want to pay. And with respect, one of the bigger members, and disappointingly so, and I'm saying this openly in Parliament, is Telkom. Telkom does not want to belong to the credit office. And why does, what does Telkom do? Every time, sir, you take out a contract with Telkom, they'll do a bureau listing. They use the access of the credit bureau to see your creditworthiness, whether you qualify. Telkom could give you incidental credit. Now, a big SOE or private like Telkom does not want. Honorable Chair, there was nothing I could do. I just had to accept that. Okay, it's voluntary, I'll have to use other persuasive methods to bring you in. So you see that if companies like that withdraw from us, but that has changed now. Now this bill has made it compulsory for you to belong to an ombudsman, and very, very welcomed. Section 215, the obligation to comply with governing rules of recognized industry ombudsman scheme. A financial institution that is a member of a recognized industry must comply with the governing rules of the scheme. And then 215.2, without limiting any other right that a financial customer of a financial institution that is a member of a recognized may have. The financial customer may enforce the obligation in subsection 1 in relation to a financial product or a financial service as if the obligation were a provision of the contract in terms of which the financial product or financial service was provided to the financial customer. Again, it's the recognition of an industry of the scheme. Honorable Chair, the issue of finally of my first theme, quality control. The quality of services provided by an ombuds scheme is imperative for the credibility of all the ombuds in the financial system. Legitimacy is very important. You don't want an organization or a perception of the public that these ombuds are biased, that they will fight in favor of industry, they're paid by industry, they pockets of industry, so it's not worth going to them. We have to change that perception, and gladly so, I'm thankful that we don't suffer from that perception. But quality control is very, very important, and we support the provisions in the bill that relate to quality control of our various offices and ensure optimum service delivery. Again, I quote a couple of sections. Ensure adequate quality control and oversight. And then these are section 200, procedure for varying, suspending, and revoking recognition of an ombuds scheme. Compliance, it's our duty to comply with all financial sector laws. There can be debarments in the event of we not playing the game. We can be, there's administrative penalties. And, the Ombuds Council or the Chief Ombuds has the right to do on-site inspections and investigations. Honourable Chair, those are the five themes that I've covered, but I just want to go through some general observations and raise a couple of sections. Section 176, objective. The Ombuds Council is to assist in ensuring that financial customers have access to and are able to use affordable, effective, independent, and fair alternative dispute resolution processes for complaints about financial institutions in relation to financial products, financial services, and services provided by market infrastructure. The jurisdictions of the various ombuds may have to be widened or amended to accommodate the above-stated objective of the Ombud Council. The potential impact of this widened jurisdiction is not clear, but may be far-reaching. A similar concern arises out of the provision of Section 211, in terms of which the Ombuds Council has the power to assign complaints to a scheme. And this is an issue that relates to jurisdiction. Let's take a very, very, very practical example. Honourable Chair, in the credit world, a very common practice that is happening is there's companies out there that seek to find you credit. It's a website, there are a couple of them. So what they do is that you are interested in getting credit, you register with them with the intention that they will find you the best option. They don't find you any credit. What they do is that monthly they debit your account with a fee of about 150, 200 rand, and they call it a service fee. Now, look at that matter in terms of they're not extending credit, they're not a credit provider, they say they're a service provider to access you to get better credit, or whatever, but they're charging you a fee of 150 rand a month for a year, and it's very difficult to get out of it. I don't have jurisdiction over them because it's not credit bureau matters. Who has jurisdiction over them? Probably the National Consumer Commission, because it's a kind of pyramid scheme or elements like that. Now, if the Ombuds Council comes and says, Mr. Credit Ombuds, I want you to deal with these matters, to take complaints from people relating to this new thing that's out there where they're fishing for credit and charging you a monthly fee. Now, for me to do that, firstly, will he be bound by my decision? Would he accept my decision? The other thing is that there will be so many complaints in regard to that particular type of activity that my office will be overwhelmed. I need resources. I need funding. Where is that coming from? What's going to pay for it? So that's a consideration. You're going to get that in terms of my colleagues and their various product lines, short-term insurance, long-term insurance. Falls between somewhere, nobody has it, it's assigned to an ombuds, you do it. But when it's assigned, it normally has international importance, it has repercussions. This happened in the United Kingdom about 5 or 4 years ago, mis-selling of insurance. You know, the UK, they call them FOSO, their financial ombuds scheme, they employ 4,500 people in one sentence. 4,500 people, they have statutory body. When this PPI thing came, they had to get a further 1,000 people to attend to that. Fortunately, they are statutory. Fortunately, Moneyball would pay for that. In our case, who's going to pay for it? And that needs to be considered. And then reporting. Section 217.
This is not helping us.
Okay. This section will require the ombuds officers to report to the council in some detail. The issue here is that this reporting requirement might have, and we don't know the level of data that is expected of us, and we would appreciate that when the bill is enacted, we meet the chief ombud or the so-called chief ombud and work out what is requested or required of us to ensure that we know what to do. Honourable Chair, this is a previous submission that we had made previously. This bill refers to somebody called a chief ombud. We objected to the term chief ombud during the National Assembly process. We objected to the term chief ombud because we thought that it's a misnomer, it's a creating false impression, because what does an ombudsman do? An ombudsman determines cases on the facts before it. What is the purpose of this chief ombuds as prescribed in the bill? He performs merely the administrative function. So we thought that that title is not correct. We requested that it be changed to ombuds director. I'm told that during the deliberations in the National Assembly, we once again overturned. But I just want to make a practical example in terms of what this chief ombuds would do. So I make a decision, and when this bill is in place or the act is in place, and the consumer is not happy with my decision. So he tells me, no, I'm going to take you to the chief ombudsman. What's the chief ombudsman going to do? Nothing, because he doesn't deal with cases. He deals with the administration of the office. He's there to direct us to do things. So we must be careful to create this impression that we have a higher step to go to when there is nothing he can do about it. He doesn't have the capacity to deal with the cases. He doesn't adjudicate all the matters before him. So we made this objection previously. I'm raising it again. We've asked for that to be changed to upper director. Honourable Chair, there's just some technical inaccuracies which is self-evident. It's just cross-referencing, and I don't want to go into that. It's just I highlighted that to the officials from National Treasury. And Honourable Chair, I thank you very much. And on behalf of my fellow ombudsman, we thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mahan. Honourable members, this was very informative. Because this is our first engagement with the ombudsman. We're going to allow now for questions. It's 3 minutes past 12 until 10 minutes past 12 to give enough time for the reply. Also to the Treasury, the Reserve Bank is here, I believe. Yes, that we adjourn at 1 and not later than 13 hours. That members that's participating in the debate can have that that space before 2 o'clock. Can we take the questions? From my side, thank you for what you are doing to protect consumers. In terms of your PRO, how is your message spread in rural areas of South Africa? Talking about a place like Kranskop in KZN, Yugi in the Eastern Cape, Van Zyl's Rust in the Northern Cape, and so we can carry on. This is part of the education exercise because this will be televised on Channel 4 away. It's part of that process. But as we take it further, I would like to hear from you. Yes, members, Honorable Mohai, I've noticed, Honorable Isha, Honorable Shipping, Honorable Tablanche, and Honorable Gaylor. In that order, please proceed.
Thanks, Chairperson. Also want to appreciate the information from the offices here that they have shared with the committee. It's quite valuable and provide insight into how they operate. So it's most welcomed, and also particularly the last presentation which was done on behalf of all the will be quite critical in us taking the process forward on the legislation, the amendment. So it has flagged issues and provided substantive information that will put us at ease as members of the committee to deal with these issues and to take the process of formulating the legislation forward. So that I appreciate, and I don't want to engage with the report, the last presentation, with that understanding that is going to generate ideas which the committee has to look at the committee stage to discuss it further.
But actually, it's 100% thank you.
Chair, but I think the Ombuds office is present here. Fully appreciate as well that the finance, the banking, and the insurance sector historically is what we characterize as untransformed sector over a period of time, that more often in fact the need, the relevance, even more often this industry, the insurance industry, more often acts like a predatory in a predatory manner, because issues of profit are involved. They exist also in order to maximize profit. So there are specific areas that were pointed out. I think the point that was made that far too many consumers do not understand their rights. And also the industry that we dealing with, also the insurance sector, is also very robust with its marketing strategies. It's not like really generating so much interest that people believe that they can take various orders. But the challenge for me is on the recall. They play a very important office, a very important role to mediate in the interest of the consumer. But what worries me was what is the recall in an area, in an event where there is no agreement, the recall to say that they go to court. Most of the people require even third party to make a very solid case. In an instance to go to court, issues of resources are at play. And that's where I think majority of people are at the receiving end with regard to products that they may have thought that they would work for them. But any slight provocation, failure to understand some details involved may leave them at the receiving end. But the last question, I don't think it's a question, but it's more of an information. I do have a sense into how home offices are structured. Some have indicated to say we've got 21, we've got this. But it may be useful just to understand fully how they are structured. But also important to understand the board of directors. The board of directors, to what extent are they representative, this board of directors? Do you source services from private attorneys to deal with certain cases or not, or does it largely depend on internal capacity? Thanks.
Honorable Geller?
Yes, sir, sorry. Chairperson, yes, thank you for the opportunity. Honorable Mohai did cover somewhat. I'll attempt to be brief so that I could afford my other colleagues to chance, because I see time is not very much on our side. Chairperson, go quick and I'll skip a few of the other questions. The presentation by Mr. McLaren, thank you. I think it was very informative and detailed. So were the others. Quick one is, well, I numbered the slides. I got the slide 3, Chairperson. At the bottom, the last, second last bullet, independent external assessor. My question here is, should that independent external assessor now be appointed? Who will be liable for the cost? How are you able to now pay this independent assessor in terms of the costings, etc.? Where do you get the funding? And then, of course, Chairperson, quickly on the same one, the last one is quality control. Perhaps you could just very briefly summarize, Mr. McLaren, what are the terms for measurement in terms of your quality control? I can understand you mentioned quality control, but it's just end of day for me. Then, quickly, Chairperson, if I might go to the presentation of Mr. Pillay, I've got about 5-6 questions, but I'm not going to ask them all. Mr. Pillay, you mentioned in your presentation equity jurisdiction. I somehow or the other couldn't grasp fully what were you exactly implying there. Perhaps you just want to touch on that so that you can educate me. And again, on slide 4, the percentage resolved in favor of complainants was only a meager 24%. I was just trying to get to terms with why only 24%. And then, Chairperson, last one is, yes, that was very informative. You explained in detail, and I think it's so true, that, you know, materialism has become a way of life for many of us here in South Africa. And unfortunately, the culture of savings is just not there. Going to have to start somewhere in terms of educating from primary school on. That's great. Now, just quickly, in terms of ongoing communication and building relationships with clients so that they know where to turn to when in trouble, how do you propose to roll that out? Okay, and then, Chairperson, I think I'll stop there before my other colleagues attend. Yeah, fine. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. I've already
cricket. Yes, indeed, materialism becomes a trend to the have. To the have-nots, it doesn't matter. It is not a norm in society. I have just certain issues that I would want my learned friends to clarify. You see, I see here on this slide that relates to bank services. It doesn't appear. It's slide number 7, if it's a slide, or page 7. I see the files opened. I'm asking this question in relation to what you earlier said in terms of the rural nature of the province where you come from, the same as the Northwest province. It's very rural in nature, and how do your services as an ombudsman get to be utilized by people in the farthest part of the province where I come from, the Northwest? Because I don't see this being a very important also bank here, the post office. I'm not sure if you've listed them all or is an omission, or you intend to work with the post offices because it provides also the banking services for the poorest people in rural communities. Chairperson, I'm sitting here and I'm trying to get an understanding of your earlier statement that you made. you earlier said we must provide oversight on ombudsmen and all that in the future. You would want it to be part of our program. But when I was looking at the slide that deals with the role of the ombudsman for long-term insurance, this is not listed. Page 2, the features of the office says the accountability to or instruct, not that one, accountable for governance and performance only to ombuds council. A question has also been asked by your good self about how the council is constituted and the powers and functions of that council. But that is not my area. The area where I'm coming from is where, in terms of the ombudsman, does Parliament play a role? Because, as they say, they are only accountable to the council. And if it is a jurist, the ombudsman is a juristic person, and if it is that, to what extent is it accountable to the Public Finance Management Act in terms of the finances allocated to it, where it accounts and what has been in operation for the past financial year? Chair, I would also, in the interest of time, I don't have many questions, like, I don't want to think that these were the last.
Are you done?
Yes.
Honourable Blanche?
Thank you, Chairperson. I really find the presentation very informative, but I must admit I'm also a bit concerned. If you look at all the complaints that were made, registered, and you see the results achieved, I'm just wondering, you know, my perception is at the moment that we are merely scratching the surface, so to speak. And I was just wondering whether the good people over there are doing market research now and again to determine customer satisfaction, and maybe to the people that help with it, how satisfied are they? And what is their perception? Dealing with the financial institutions is very cumbersome now, that you're speaking to computers, you don't get to actual people, but leave it there. The market research issue is my concern. Going to the first presentation, I see the funeral cover stops the list there, and I'm not surprised about that because we are getting quite a few complaints about that. People are paying for long periods, and when somebody passes on, there's a small little amount and they cannot pay for the funeral. So that is just some concern from my side. The second presentation touched on the first issue that I raised, that is the second presentation. Formal mediation, only four of them. And are we really thinking that we are doing something in this field? Taking all this complaints that was registered, I'm very concerned about that. Provisional recommendation, only one. So what have we been doing all along? Final recommendations, zero. I am concerned in person that the public, you know, are not getting the kind of assistance that they would like. That is just, you know, my observation. Now, going to the third presentation, you know, the amount that apparently got claimed back is 90 million. And my question is, what is the total amount? What is the percentage? What is the percentage that we're looking at here? And just in the last thing, you know, we are really happy that apparently in terms of good practice worldwide that, you know, the time that people are dealing with the stuff is about apparently 60 days. So we are really happy that we are, you know, round about at the ballpark. My concern is if you are Mr. Joe or Billy out in the street, you need to wait for a final response for 60 or 90 days. Then Joe or Billy is in trouble. So really I think that, you know, personally, on the surface, I'm not satisfied that the people out there are really have any reason to be satisfied with this moment. Thank you, Chairperson.
I appreciate the presentation and also your chairperson that you enjoyed speaking in your company. Thank you very much. However, just a few pointers. I'm not sure I agree with you that South Africans are over indebted. And as you say that some of them sign and they don't know what are they signing. But sometimes the fine print, that fine print, and I don't know how can that be resolved because most of them chase and get into that trap because of that fine print. And I must admit, even myself, I don't have time to go through that fine print because it's at the last minute. So I think something needs to be done about that fine print. No. Chairperson, where I am from.
Yeah, I speak to myself as well.
Yeah, no. I'm speaking about the people. Where I am from, the rural areas. A young man maybe has just got into job opportunities, and all of a sudden he's able to get a car and credit. He's so happy that he's got his first car. And all of you all have been in that situation. And he misses that fine print, which is his life. So it is something that needs to be looked at, that fine print, because it destroyed our people. Secondly, most of the people, they finish paying their credit, or they pay late, take it to credit bureau, listed, then they go pay after, but they're not removed from the company that provides the credit. It should be its duty to remove that person because they receive their money. I want your input on that one, but I believe it's their duty to do that because they are paid their money. It should not be the burden of the person who owes them. Then the second one is card scheming. A lot of these pensioners get into these problems. And you know what the bank says? The bank says to them, go to the police and report. But it is not of their making that their card was skimmed. I had my mother where her card was skimmed. The bank said, go and report. I said, no, you're not going to go. But I went to the bank and told them, it's your system, your security. I want that money back. But the most people in the rural areas do not know about it. One would like to know what your feedback on it. And then the last one is what my colleague was saying. The funeral scheme. I'm talking about the poorest people here, where I am from, LOD, where you find that people pay for 30 years on a funeral scheme and they miss just one payment. And that one payment makes them not to be assisted. They paid a lot of money just because they missed one payment. Now it goes down then to you. What type of awareness do you have for these people here? Are you on the local community radios or not? We are not a problem, but when we talk of those people who do not know that you exist, how do you make sure that they know the experience? I know that it's a lot of money, but they need to know that you exist, especially with the money laundering, where they are overcharged. It happens on a daily basis. And we have these ombudsmen, which are good in nature, but how do you make those people aware that there is you are there to assist them? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, honorable members. 12:24. We must adjourn at 1 o'clock. So I'm going to give 3-4 minutes to each ombudsman to reply. I'm also going to give you the space that you can reply in writing to the secretariat if there's more information you want to give to us. The treasury is here. You don't have to reply to everything. Maybe just in general. The reserve bank is here. Advocate Champions, are there any inputs from you? None at this stage, because we're going to public hearings for 2 days, 28 and 29 of March. Public hearings, so there will be enough space for additional inputs to be made. You get direct.
Honourable Chair, thank you. And to honourable members, thank you for all of these questions. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to propose the following. There were some general questions that were dealt with in my presentation, which I'll reply to. There were specific questions which to my specific colleagues, and they picked up their specific questions. So if you don't mind, I will pick up the general question. The one that we can start with is the issue of rural outreach. The general questions that were asked were rural outreach, quality control, what's the role of Parliament in all of this? Honourable Esak asked, where do I go to when I'm in trouble? You know, that kind of stuff. And then there were specific questions arising from the various presentations. But let's start with rural outreach. In terms of rural outreach, and from the current Ombuds Office, and I think the other Ombuds have an opportunity to talk about that, we have, apart from, I have a PR team of 4 people. One based in Mpumalanga that covers the entire Mpumalanga region. I have one person based in the Eastern Cape. I have one person not based in the Eastern Cape, but from the KwaZulu-Natal, who's very familiar with the area and does a lot of outreach there. And obviously we are based in Johannesburg, and we try and do broad-based education throughout the country. We do a number of workshops all over the country. We don't specifically do the Gauteng area. We've just hired a person to do some work in the entire Mpumalanga region, because the Eastern Cape covered. The PR lady that I hired is from that area. She's very familiar with the area. So they do various workshops throughout the country. But another service that we offer, we call it double impact training. And this double impact training is where we go to our members and train the staff of our members, because we believe that a better educated staff member is in a better position to provide a service to consumers. So we're all working in terms of the rural outreach. We're very aware of the implications of footprint. We're trying our best to do that. We hope that with the Financial Sector Regulation Bill, with the now so-called chief ombud, that they, you know, direct us to establish various contact centres in the various areas. So that is, we're very mindful of that. And we also keep statistics in terms of the demographic area that it comes from to track which province or area we're getting most of it from, where do we need to do much more service, etc. So we'll give you much more in writing in that regard on behalf of all my colleagues, but just to touch on that, it's noted. However, we're not doing enough. Concede. We could do more. I concede. Okay?
Judge, for further interruption, I take honourable members back to what we heard in Mexico from one of the stakeholders, what they do at school. We must go back to that report, back to that presentation, and lessons to learn, referring to this presentation today.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The issue of quality control, an important issue, but normally we follow world best practice. There are various standards set by the International Network of Financial Ombudsmen, which we benchmark against. But to ensure proper quality control, we have an independent audit done by an independent person that has nothing to do with our office. To come into our office, we all do that. It's normally a retired judge or whatever. Take 10 files randomly. Go and look at this file and do a full report on how it performed. We can do more about that, but it's an important aspect. Thank you. Then the issue of where to go to when you're in trouble. I think the solution of that has been found in the bill. The bill makes it preemptive for credit providers, for financial services providers, for insurance companies, for short-term insurance companies, to put the name of complaints handling people in the on the contract, at the time of the contract. Okay? A very important one, Honourable Chair, was the question of the role of Parliament in PFMA. We are a voluntary organisation funded by the industry. We do not receive 1 cent from the public, from the public purse, from the government purse. We don't get no money from government at all. In terms of this new legislation, there's going to be the creation of the Ombuds Council. Credit providers and financial services providers will have to pay for the setup of that structure. They'll have to pay for members of the Ombuds Council, the chief ombud, his team, all of that, officers, whatever the case may be. So because we do not receive any bit of government funding, we are not subject to the PFMA, the Public Finance Management Act, because it's not public finance that we receive. We receive our funding from the industry on a various methods within all of us that we do. On the question of accountability, when we say we're accountable to our board, and because we are voluntary, the accountability is in relation to an independent board. Parliament is probably the most important institution, but one of the things that this bill brings in is that you must comply with the laws of the land, and Parliament is the one that makes the laws of the land. So, you know, I think that we have two different things about accountability. And because we're not a public statutory body, we don't have to come to Parliament like our statutory counterparts, pension fund adjudicator, as well as the vice ombud, who are obliged to come and do a report to you every year because they are created by the statute. And the statute states that you are accountable to Parliament. You have that. We are voluntary. And we come here voluntary. We come here on invitation. We don't come here by statute. And we thank you for your invitation. Okay?
We'll call you again. Okay.
Before I hand over to my colleague, I want to, the gentleman, the honourable member that raised the question of over-indebtedness. You believe that we're not over-indebted. I beg to differ. Look at the statistics, and I'll send you all the statistics to show where we're going. The Department of Trade and Industry in the National Assembly are having discussions on debt forgiveness programs. Why? If we're not over-indebted, why do we want to have debt forgiveness programs? So I beg you to forward that. So I will send you details to show you the exact position in that regard. The always indebtedness position. It's critical.
Maybe you must send it to the secretariat.
I'll reply to you and I'll give you all the details in that regard. I think maybe
order.
I think I can stop now and I can offer my colleagues an opportunity to pick up all the other questions.
Thank you, Chair. I'll deal with Mr. Issa's two questions first. Your first question, as I understand it, is what does equity jurisdiction mean? Equity jurisdiction means ensuring fairness between the parties in the dispute. So, for example, if the relationship between the two parties is founded on or governed by a contract, and the ombudsman finds that the strict adherence or application of a clause in that contract could have or lead to undue hardship to the consumer, then the ombudsman can ignore that clause to ensure fairness between the parties. Okay? Sorry? Thank you. Can I move to the second question? Now, your second question is...
Just proceed. Carry on with your response.
Okay. The second question is, how can you only find 24% in favor of consumers? Now, the answer to that question is the following. We adjudicate disputes. So there's a complaint and there's a dispute between two parties. To arrive at an answer, there has to be fault or maladministration on the part of one or other party. So if the bank is at fault, we'll find against the bank. If the consumer is at fault, we'll find against the consumer. But what we have found increasingly is that we have a number of complaints where there's no fault on the part of the bank. There's not even an allegation of fault on the part of the bank. Increasingly, the complaints are from debt. Increasingly, the complaints are from debt-stressed consumers who simply want to restructure the debt. So that it comes to us as a complaint. But clearly, in a case like that, we can't find in favor of the consumer. Yes, so we refer them to a debt counselor. Can I move to Mr. DeBlanc? Mr. DeBlanc, you said that you find it difficult to understand how there was only one provisional recommendation and no final recommendation. You may recall that the procedure is the following. You do an assessment first. If the parties accept the assessment, that's where it ends. If the parties don't accept the assessment, it then goes to investigation. If the parties accept the investigation, that's where it ends. If the parties don't accept the investigation, it goes to a provisional recommendation. If the parties don't accept the provisional recommendation, it then goes to a final recommendation. So with respect to you, sir, it's the other way around. The fact that there are no recommendations is a good thing. That means the cases were settled at the assessment stage, 74% as I mentioned earlier, and 23% plus or more or less at the investigation stage. So the statistics are good. It's the other way around. The next question is whether we do customer satisfaction Our mandate is to adjudicate disputes. So we don't, right, we don't assess the bank's performance. But we do, but we do assess our performance from a customer's perspective. So when, upon completion of every case, we ask the customer to complete a satisfaction survey. The results of those surveys are published every year in our annual report for everybody to see. The last question was four more mediations. Only four mediations? The reason why there's only four is because, remember, the bank and the customer are in dispute. There's a dispute between them. So they're not inclined to mediate. And not all matters, that's number one. Number two, not all matters are suitable for mediation. So to mediate, you need both parties to say, look, let's mediate, we'll accept a compromise. When the parties are in dispute, it's very hard to get them to accept a compromise. So that's the reason why mediations are not that high. Thank you, Chief.
Wood and then Ms. McLean.
Thank you for the questions. I'm just going to go through a few of them that relate to me generally. I think there was only one specific question for my office. As far as rural outreach is concerned, for the short-term insurance industry, most of the complaints arise out of a contract that's concluded between two parties. Our details are published in those contracts, so they are given to the consumers at the inception of the contract. And also when a decision is made in terms of that contract, a rejection of a claim, and a letter is sent again, our details are published and the consumers are invited to approach our offices. And that goes a long way to giving parties in rural areas who receive these notifications the details, where to contact us and what we can do for them. We also run workshops, and we publish in the media as widely as we can. We use radio, television, and print media to publish our services, and we try to do that in publications that are generally read in the rural areas. That said, there is a lot more that can be done. As a collective body, we are exploring a roadshow in order to try and reach some of the rural areas. Funding for that has been difficult, and also, unfortunately, we're also quite overwhelmed with workloads, but it is on our project as one of the things that we would hope to do as a collective body, and we have already published a brochure to setting out all of our details to be made available to people so that they have us all on one page. The recourse where there is no agreement and parties must go to court, we were asked questions around that. Within our office, we have intricate procedures in place to ensure that every complaint is handled and dealt with to the very last point of examination. So a complaint is handled initially, and if a consumer is unhappy with the result of the first line of handling, it can be escalated up the line. And if they continue to be unsatisfied with the result, it will go right to our office and finally come to me, and I will consider it and then give a recommendation. And if they're still unhappy with that, then they can appeal the process. So there are quite a lot of steps available to a consumer to get a very wide range of legal opinions before they need to approach court. We were also asked if we ever source attorneys. Our office doesn't source attorneys because all of our assistants who handle the complaints are in fact qualified attorneys, and they also have specifically a lot of experience in the actual industry. As an advocate in my office, in order to be appointed in my position, you have to either be a senior counsel or a retired judge. So again, it's somebody who has had quite a fair degree of legal experience. The board of directors, I think we each dealt with our board of directors in our presentations and who they are. I know that all of us also have those details available on our website, so you can see who are in fact sitting on our boards and where they come from. And then I think it was the 90 million question that we were asked. Our overturn rate is 27% of all complaints. There are a number of reasons that it's not sitting closer to 50%. One of them is in fact that industry itself has internal schemes set up inside within the industry. Once a rejection, a claim is rejected, it goes to that scheme. Some of the insurers in fact employ retired judges. My predecessor is also employed as a consultant to insurers to assess rejections before a letter is sent to make sure that it is in fact correct. And our offices have had a big impact on industry actually towing the line and making sure that their rejections and their conduct is far better, which explains goes to some way to explaining that percentage. We also receive a lot of complaints that simply are sent to us in a last-ditch attempt to try and get some redress where there isn't actually a case. So, for example, we receive a high volume of cases where an accident has happened where the party has been drinking, and they get a lot of those cases. The insurer clearly is entitled not to pay a claim if you have, if there is an indication that you have been drinking. They provide a lot of evidence, including medical reports, to show that the insured was in fact drunk at the time of the accident. We get a lot of those, and we also, in a repressed environment, get a lot of desperate complaints where there really is no case. So that also explains our low overturn rate, or our 27%. And then as far as turnaround times are concerned, we have to allow for due process, and unfortunately that does sometimes take time. The more complex the matter, the longer it takes. Often, the shorter the turnaround times, it does tend to favour industry, because you can't investigate a complaint, and it's easier then to just uphold their decision. So in fact, sometimes having a slightly longer turnaround time can be to the consumer's advantage. I understand that there is money at play, and it can be frustrating. We do take it very seriously, and we do push turnaround times as hard as we can. But sometimes there are very complex matters that require experts and detailed consideration. And I think that was all that was for me. Thank you.
Thank you. The question about the independent external assessor, it's a retired High Court judge dealing with cases ad hoc, appointed by the council. It may very well be, once the bill has been enacted, that role will fall away. That person serves a function, provides a place where complaints against the office can be lodged, both by complainants and by insurers. It's also part of our quality control. We try to refer the minimum of 5% to 8%. We're aiming for 10% of completed matters to a practicing advocate in Cape Town for external evaluation. Our system of provisional ruling followed by final determination is also part of the quality control, as is our internal appeal process. Every second year we have a survey amongst complainants and insurers to test the measure of performance of the office, not whether they like us or don't like us. The last survey was published in our 2014 annual report, which is on our website. As far as equity jurisdiction is concerned, I endorse exactly what Advocate Fillet said, and I would like to use an example which the gentleman posed about the person who pays for a funeral policy for 30 years and then misses one premium. On the strict terms of the contract, that person will not have a claim. Our equity jurisdiction is designed precisely for application in that kind of matter, because we are not then bound by the letter of the contract, but by the spirit of the agreement. Section 196(3), subsection 2 or 3
of the present world particularly requires that before you can be recognized as an ombudsman scheme, you must, the rules must require the ombud to apply, where appropriate, principles of equity when dealing with a complaint. This is a carrying over from the Financial Services Ombud Schemes Act. It is statutorily imposed, and we all adhere to that, and it is entrenched in our rules. As far as the appointment of our board is concerned, rather than namely persons who serve on our board, the members standing in the community, the chairperson is Judge Leona Tron, who is a member of the bench in the Supreme Court of Appeal. I happen to bring a copy of our 2015 annual report, which has got photographs and their names and a short description of where each of them comes from, and I'd like to use the opportunity as soon as we adjourn to give a copy to you. And I think that also answers Mr. Sparge's question on the survey. If anybody would like to hear more about our office's outreach to the rural areas, please start with that.
Thank you, Judge, and thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to deal with the question relating to the funeral scheme. The first question was about means one payment and practical notice.
Can you bring the mic?
Thank you. And you know, we are not assisted. It is very important that when you receive a policy contract, you read the terms and conditions of the policy. Some of the funeral policies, they do have provisions which is known as a premium holiday, where you are unable to pay the premium, you inform the insurance company concerned, and then they allow you to skip the premium. Some of them, they do provide a grace period during the time that you are unable to pay. And then you will be allowed to skip a further premium, but they will then do a double deduction so that your policy and your premiums are kept in order. Another question which was imposed, how do we market ourselves, how do we trade awareness? Most of the speakers have already alluded to the fact that we advertise in local radio stations. We are also being invited to TV shows. We do road shows as well. We do have brochures in the offices, in our office, where we explain in detail what our services entail. So in that manner, I believe we do reach out to the very rural areas. Another question that was asked was why funeral campaign stops in our presentation. I think it does clearly shows that people, they do understand that our office does exist. It's easily accessible because when you get a policy contract, they do, most of the insurance companies, they do have our details. So that in the event that you have a complaint, they do access our offices very easily. Another thing which I think, in my view, why funeral contains stops is because in South Africa, in general, you know, most people are black. And black people, they are only able to take funeral policies because that's a very cheap policy. So it reflects our population in South Africa.
Reserve Bank? Any inputs from you? None? Treasury?
Thank you, Chair. I think really what the discussion today has highlighted most of all is the importance of a much stronger awareness drive, because we have an office system, and it is, there might be weaknesses within it, but it is generally working. But when you look at the numbers and you compare the number of people coming, lodging complaints and coming through the system compared to, so for example, on the indebtedness side, we're talking about millions of people versus a few thousand of your lodging complaints. Like, it's clearly a mismatch there. And so this goes to the heart of why did we need these reforms through and why they are urgent. And I think the sector or the industry and the ombuds and the statutory ombuds recognize this, and really the 20s bill paved the way for this consolidated impact. We can do more with what we've got, and I think this is the opportunity to be doing so. Just another point on the, you know, talking about the fine print and our people reading, I think we must also not overlook that ombuds is just one component of the broader consumer protection framework for the financial sector, for financial customers. So if we take this example of a funeral policy missing one payment and you're not covered, that's a product design issue. And actually, even if it isn't the fine print, we know that us as individuals, we're not going to read all that detail. So firstly, the product needs to be designed in a way that they are fair in the first instance. And secondly, the way in which disclosure happens has to understand how people interpret information. And there's a lot of work and effort going to understand the behavioral responses that we have as customers so that we can be better shaping the instruments and the tools that we've got. And that really does go to the heart again. When you're talking about setting up a conduct authority, it's not just a new organization. It's changing the way in which we really are trying to help and facilitate and support more empowered financial customers.
I noted the hands of Honorable Gayla. I'm giving you 2 seconds.
No, I just wanted to clear something so that you don't get the wrong impression. I didn't think South Africans are not over indebted. You got me wrong. And lastly, Chairperson, I want to support you that we must always meet with them, because we deal with people down there. So today, as from today, I'll be able to give those people information. And those people are not educated that we deal with. They are the ones that are vulnerable. So it's very important what you said, and I support you on this one. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Honorable Lotara, is there a program meeting tomorrow? Because I want you to speak to the program, but then we can do it at tomorrow's meeting.
Chairperson, I am not sure as soon as we do have the program.
Okay.
Or confirm with the committee panel.
There's going to be amendments to the NCP program. I'm just sensitizing all the members. To the ombuds, thank you very much. You educated us this morning. All the members, we are going to a constituency period, and you're going to get the question, what did you do in the first quarter in Parliament? This is part of your report back to our people at grassroots level. What did you do? We engage the ombuds and inform our people and take that message further to our poor households that don't have the opportunity to come to Parliament and sit in committee meetings. Not everyone is accessed to DSTV, Channel 408. That responsibility is on us to go and inform our people. I want honourable members to read Section 69 of the Constitution, the role of the NCP, and who the NCP and its committees can call to come and account. I'm not going to read that paragraph. Thank you to the bank, and thank you to the National Treasury. All the members, I received an email from the person you know very well, Alejandra Cabrera, that a contract came to an end, and she sent best wishes to the committee. And on behalf of the committee, I wished her very well, because she's getting married in the near future. I think within the next month. So we wish her well in a new life that we call power sharing. That's another way to deal with that. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of the business of the meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.